of news to get to. So we got to get Tom in here right away. So bring him in door number three, would you? A bigger door. I thought we'd have an easier time. All right, bring him in the regular door. All right, you want to make it hard on yourself? All right, fellas, bring him in. Bring him in. Bring him in. There he is. Don't forget his fan. Don't forget his fan this time. You all right, Tom?
Yeah, it's not as hot as it was yesterday, but I still have my trusty fan.
All right, diving in. Oh, it's warm. Gather around, small woodland animals. Let's get started with the news. By the way, why is Pine Lake Park, this is a call out to anybody, why is the park still closed? You can't go in there. You can't park in there. Come on, people. Come on, free us. Free us there in Sammamish. It's hot. All right, so Big Tech got an opportunity to sit there, and this was more Kabuki theater again, because really nothing's going to come of this, but you get a chance to see these guys sit there. This is Mark Zuckerberg's third time back, and apparently he did not need a booster chair for this one. He's sitting there. You got Jeff Bezos. I forget which square he was in. You got the head of Apple in there. Mr. Cook is in there. You got the head of Google is in there. Interesting. Poor old Microsoft, which used to get all the heat for antitrust, wasn't even mentioned on this. So there we are. We've got our four guys, and they are not. The great thing about it is the Republicans hate them because they think that they are stopping them from having, quote unquote, free speech, even though it's a platform right. that's not public. And then the Democrats don't like them because they don't like the fact that they're letting Facebook put up stuff that's not considered hate speech. Plus, also, they don't like the fact that they see these guys as running big monopolies. So,
yeah,
it wasn't very friendly for any of them. Here's the opening statement from Jeff Bezos, which is, he's never done this before.
The retail market we participate in is extraordinarily large and competitive. Amazon accounts for less than 1% of the $25 trillion global retail market and less than 4% of U.S. retail. There's room in retail for multiple winners. We compete against large, established players like Target, Costco, Kroger, and, of course, Walmart, a company more than twice Amazon's size.
Twice their size in what regard? Twice their size in sales, twice the size in revenue, twice the size of employees, twice the size of what? Capital?
It's twice the size of whatever breaks in Amazon's
yeah,
favor.
No kidding.
That's what they mean. They don't mean
you can have 100 employees at Amazon doing what 50,000 employees are doing at Walmart. Yeah. Let's see. We got, does Jayapal make a speech and get a lot of time?
No, there are a whole bunch of interesting arguments, and she has an interesting particular take on this and his response.
Okay, so let's get well, she did a great job making speeches yesterday. Here we go.
So let me ask you, Mr. Bezos, does Amazon ever access and use third-party seller data when making business decisions? And just a yes or no will suffice, sir.
Okay, that question is basically third-party information. So that means Bob Smith makes little widgets, sells them on Amazon's site, gets money. Amazon then has an algorithm in there that says, oh, look, Bob Smith's widgets are selling really well. What's his price? What is his product? Can we off-ship this to China, have this thing built there, and then undercut Mr. Smith, right?
Yes, and that is what the Wall Street Journal exposed in this great article a few months ago about that, and that's what she's asking him about.
So the question is, will we get a yes or no answer from Jeff Bezos?
But I can't answer that question yes or no. What I can tell you is we have a policy against using seller-specific data to aid our private label business, but I can't guarantee you that that policy has never been violated.
Okay, good. There you go. He's a policies in place.
Yeah.
All right. There. Good. Good answer. There's a policy, and they just choose to ignore it.
Ignore it.
You're
talking
to the third-party shippers. They're like, I see this happening. I know they're doing
this.
All the time. Listen, if you control the store and you control all the data and you're letting somebody come in and set stuff up in your store, and then you're seeing, hey, look at all the people buying stuff. Now, Amazon gets a chunk of the guy's revenue.
That's
but
right.
But doesn't get the whole thing. Why shouldn't they take the whole thing?
Well, because some of those sellers might find there might be a good competitor on Amazon for Amazon that would allow for this kind of stuff. But they've announced in their policy, it'd be like saying, hey, I'm going to sell you a car. And yeah, all the tires are new. And it turns out that none of the tires are new, but you bought it on the assumption that all the tires were new.
Mm-hmm.
When you find out that they indeed do this, if they do it, it's that your policy says you don't do it. And that's why he's kind of caught.
Yes.
They're caught between a rock and a hard place because they claim to be moral, arbiters of the way business should be run. But in reality, according to people that have worked at Amazon, say, no, we do this all the time. And that's why he has to kind of hide behind the fig leaf of, well, we have a policy that says we don't do that.
I talked to a friend of mine who sells stuff on Etsy. I said, how's that go for
you? Oh, yeah.
She makes jewelry. She said, here's the crazy thing. Now, realize, you're an art person. You're making stuff out of toenails and, whatever, old cat, dried up cat litter.
Yes.
We read down into the depths. She goes, but here's what they do to you at Etsy. If you have a product that is selling well, they will then take your product and put it up on their front page, right, as an advertisement. Mm-hmm. So now all of a sudden, your cat litter that has been dried and carved into small little monkeys is up there. You're like, well, check that out. But then Etsy then takes 25% of your revenue sales.
Because they claim they're promoting it.
Right. But she said, I didn't want them to do that. In fact, she goes, I was praying to God, please, please don't pick one of my items. And sure enough, they took the most popular item that I was making the most amount of money with. Boom, up to the top it goes. On the front page it goes. And they start taking 25% off. She goes, well, it just killed me because that's my baby. That's the one I really make the money on.
The argument, though, from Amazon's point of view, I would assume, or Etsy's point of view, is that by promoting you, we will take 25% of your profits, but your profits will double from when before. I mean, that would, I think, would be the economic argument.
I understand.
If that's not the case,
Prove it.
It really is screwed.
Right. She said, the thing is that the people have found me. I have my customers. I've got my
business. Yeah, okay.
I don't need you to advertise. And they make it really easy to find the products on there. Okay. More from Bezos. Bezos' response to accusations raised at Wall Street Journal article earlier this year. This is the fact that third party gets screwed.
Mr. Bezos, you're probably aware that an April 2020 report in the Wall Street Journal revealed that your company does access data on third-party sellers, both by reviewing data on popular individual sellers and products and by creating tiny product categories that allowed your company to categorically access detailed seller information in a supposedly aggregate category. Do you deny that report?
I'm familiar with the Wall Street Journal article that you're talking about, and we continue to look into that very carefully. I'm not yet satisfied that we've gotten to the bottom of it, and we're going to keep looking at it.
Okay.
It's not as easy to do as you would think because some of the sources in the article are anonymous, but we continue to look into it.
Okay, that's good. He's policing his own people. Like, he doesn't know that's happening. Okay.
I mean, the thing is, at least he's not out and out denying it.
No.
There's an interesting
Tom,
sort of over.
He's smart enough. They know what's coming, right? They were supposed to do this a while ago. They put it off.
Yeah.
They know exactly what their vulnerabilities are. They know the articles that are out there, and he's just like, "Oh yeah, we'll look into that," knowing that they're never going to follow up. There's this thing has been going on for a year and a half. They've had everybody under age of 30 years old digging through all of this stuff, trying to put all this together, and then turning around to the people that write the questions for these guys. Like, for instance, Nadler from New York, who probably doesn't know how to turn a computer on. They write the questions for them, and they have it all down. But they've been working a year and a half. Bezos knows how to answer. Each one of these guys knows how to answer these questions.
Well, the thing is that according to the overview link, I can't remember now whose live updates
Journal.
We were watching. It was Wall Street Journal. They said that Jeff Bezos took a different tack. Everybody else said, No, that's not true. We don't do that. Uh-huh. Zuckerberg and Google and Alphabet, the Google parent company, said, no, we don't do that. They said Bezos had the opposite, not the opposite approach, but a refreshing approach. And then he says, really? I didn't know that. Well, we'll have to look into this. Sort of like accepting it's like letting the bull run by your red cape and then go, we'll take a look at it. So he doesn't get gored right then because he says, well, that's not the policy, but we are investigating to see if we are somehow letting our policy not be enforced.
Okay, so let's see how Zuckerberg does. Asked if he could explain why Donald Trump Jr. temporarily suspended from Twitter. This has got to be Republican asking this.
It was reported that Donald Trump Jr. got taken down for a period of time because he put something up on the efficacy of hydroxychloroquine. Now, I wouldn't take it myself, but there still is a debate on whether it is effective either in treating or preventing COVID-19. Why did that happen?
Congressman.
I have a feeling that guy's going in the wagon right now. No, I said he's going to be there with the teeny tiny lady. Well, how did that happen?
Well, first, to be clear, I think what you might be referring to happened on Twitter, so it's hard for me to speak to that. But I can talk to our policies about this. We do prohibit content that will lead to imminent risk of harm. And stating that there's a proven cure for COVID when there is, in fact, none, might encourage someone to go take something that could have some adverse effects. So we do take that down.
Okay, wow. I bet that guy's like, I had one time to ask a question, and you gave me the wrong guy. I had the wrong guy. I got that a good question. Who was I supposed to ask that to? Which one of the... Who? Who's that? Which one's that?
Now, to be fair, though, Facebook also took down the same video that Twitter was referencing. But still, I know. It was a nice rhetorical move.
Oh, God. Did they have that on TV? Did they have that on? Did they?
I hope they don't play that on a Tom and Curly show. I'll never live it down.
I look like a fool. I had a hard enough time figuring out what Twitter was.
Why did that happen?
All right, here's Jerry Nadler, who, God love him, he survived that horrible car accident yesterday. Asking Zuckerberg about their acquisitions into Instagram, violation of antitrust.
In your own words, you purchased Instagram to neutralize a competitive threat. If this was an illegal merger at the time of the transaction, why shouldn't Instagram now be broken off into a separate company?
Well, Congressman, I think the FTC had all of these documents and reviewed this and unanimously voted at the time not to challenge the acquisition. I mean, I think with hindsight, it probably looks like obvious that Instagram would have reached the scale that it has today, but at the time it was far from obvious. A lot of the competitors that they competed with in mobile sharing, including companies like Path, which were hot at the time and had great founders and entrepreneurs running them. Dave Moore and I worked closely with him. I mean, I don't even think Path exists today. It was not a guarantee.
Guy in the back. I had Path. I still have Path. Why? How did that happen?
Guarantee that Instagram was going to succeed. I think that this has been an American success story.
Mr. Zuckerberg, you're making my point. In closing, Mr. Chairman, I want to end where I began. Facebook, by Mr. Zuckerberg's own admission and by the documents we have from the time, Facebook saw Instagram as a threat that could potentially siphon business away from Facebook. And so rather than compete with it, Facebook bought it. This is exactly the type of anti-competitive acquisition that the antitrust laws were designed to prevent.
Yeah. By the way, Nadler, why don't you hobble on over and ask the people at the FTC why they approve the thing? It takes them almost 18 months to make the decision that, yes, you can do this. They did it. They gave them permission in order to buy the thing. And they went through all the lawsuits and everything. So he doesn't understand how the own part of the government works on this?
Well, the problem is, John, I mean, one could argue, because the FTC, I think they're appointed, so it could be, Republican appointees that approved it or something. It still is an issue.
Not back
and
then,
can
it
be
argued. Democrats, but it doesn't matter. It's still the FTC, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, the FTC has the power to make those decisions.
Yes.
But then the question still remains whether that was a legitimate decision or not. But still, yeah, I think that was a good response on his part. Hey, the FTC looked at it. Now, do we have Jayapal? I thought Jayapal did a good job on the Instagram business.
No, I only had the one cut from her. I have her making speeches yesterday, if you want to hear.
Okay. So let me just, on this point, just because we're dealing with the Instagram, what Jayapal produced was sort of like internal documents or internal memos about this from Instagram's founder. And he was talking about the way he felt like the Zuckerberg threatened him. Uh-huh. And so he said, so did you threaten him when you're trying to buy his company? Did you threaten him because you said you were going to develop this similar product, Facebook camera, while he was trying to do this? He saw it as a threat. Now, Zuckerberg's response was, but we had made it public that we were developing Facebook camera. So it wasn't like, unknown. Mm-hmm. I mean, it wasn't like it was a hidden. But the Instagram's founder, this guy named Kevin Systrom, said that it was clearly a threat. And he told his people at Instagram, he says, listen, they are going to go into destroy mode if we don't sell. And so he felt like he kind of had to sell them. He didn't really have a good answer for that beyond that was what the impression was. And that's the impression when you're a big enough guy on the block that anytime they say, hey, how you doing? Would you like to be, would you like us to buy you out? If you say no, then they're going to it's seen as not a kind of a threat because they'll go after destroying you. And the only reason you can afford to destroy you is because you're so big, and that's what a monopoly can do. That was one of her points.
You talk to anybody in Silicon Valley for the last 10, 15 years. I say 12 years. What are you hoping for? We're hoping we get big enough that we cause enough of a problem that we take 2% of whatever they got, that they come along and eat us. And then they buy us out for millions and millions of dollars. And then I struggle, and then I, you know, develop an app no one buys, and then I go live on an island somewhere. Then I come back with all my money, and I start doing other things. That's what they're hoping for. That's what works. By the way, the FTC closed the investigation down, non-public investigation, into Facebook acquiring Instagram. And that was August 22nd, 2012. And yes, you're right, they are appointed by Obama. So the thing is that when you get so much money from the tech companies for the campaigns in order to run for office, as they do, and support most of these Democrats, you don't want to take too big of a bite out of them because they sent this, so far, they have spent $15 million this year on for the DNC. So that is big tech.
That's nothing, though. 15 million
so far this year. That's a 16% increase over last year.
Yeah, that's not very much considering how much money they have. I'm just surprised. I thought it would be a lot more than just 15 million.
That's what that's so far, and those are from the employees, Tom. Yeah.
Oh, from the employees.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's a 16% increase over 2016.
Okay, so it's not. So we're not talking about the corporations. We're talking about individual employees.
Yeah, that are giving the money.
Yeah. Well, that's good then. Hey, we didn't even get to talk about diapers.com. Bezos was also grilled on that.
We don't have any of that sound. You know what? Jacob works hard.
No. I'm
shaking
not.
Shaving his head every 3 hours. And then you come in here. why do you keep doing that, by the way?
Why do I keep shaving my head? I'd rather not go to a haircutting place. And I have the technology.
Oh, the technology.
It's a pandemic we're living
in,
John. Leave him alone.
I was in the chair at my dentist's office. For almost 4 hours today.
What? Did you get another perm?
Sorry, I inflated it. It's only four. It's 3 hours. Did I get another perm? What is wrong with you?
What takes so long?
It was a complex dental issue, and I'm going to talk all about it.
I thought you were at a barber shop.
Mortgage 1-888-7-7-8-K-I-E-L. Here's what happens when you call that number. You tell them how much you're paying right now, and a pretty good chance, since interest rates are historically low, you could refinance, make yourself some money. 1-888-7-7-8-K-I-E-L. Thank you, Kiel Mortgage.
Thank you.
Tom, I wanted to see, just for fun, so I looked up, this is the 2020 revenues, projected revenues. This is for Walmart, $524 billion. And I want to find out what the average, I'm going to take the annual revenue, because this is, Jeff Bezos said, Walmart is bigger, right?
Yeah.
Let's see what they got. This is their annual sales. Sales revenue for fiscal year 2019, they did $280 billion.
Okay.
How about that? So half the size of Walmart.
Well, the thing is that you are doing a projection for Walmart.
I could go back to Walmart for
3 years later versus,
I just want to just for fun, just for fun,
still,
just to see 2019, just to see what they're
saying. Okay, well, I don't have,
They did $514 billion, All right, $514 billion for Walmart, 200 and some billion for Amazon. You just get the feeling that Amazon
Amazon is bigger now. I mean, aren't the Amazon numbers are from 2017, you said,
No, 2019,
right?
2019,
okay, so it's not that long ago then. Yeah, I forget, I don't have my notes in front of me. It is, the value of Amazon is, he's like one of the, the fourth highest or something or other. But anyway, they're comparable in different ways.
Got it. Learning to live with COVID risks. This is from the Wall Street Journal, basically pointing out that there are risks to everything. And when it comes to COVID, what are your chances of getting a better idea of how many people get infected, how many died? We couldn't do these numbers earlier on in March when the government kept talking about using science. They really couldn't use science because they didn't know how many people had it. We still don't exactly know that, but we're getting a better idea of what the death rate is. So in this case, the Wall Street Journal walks you through the situation. What do they say? If you're in a plane for 2 hours, a packed plane for 2 hours, the chances of getting COVID-19 is the same as what, Tom?
2 waking hours. That is a weird, it's from some MIT study, and there's just not enough background information to make that make sense to me. But it's just 2 waking hours of, you know, no matter where. It doesn't say where. Are you in a hotspot? Are you not in a hotspot? Are you socially distanced? Are you masked? But still, that's if we accepted that on face value, that whatever study there was, that you are as safe on a plane, you know, for 2 hours. Now, I don't know, a lot of plane rides people take, especially from this part of the country, they tend to be longer than 2 hours. I don't know if it would increase if it went to 3 hours or 4 hours. I don't know. But yes, that's one of the things that he's arguing, that we are more fearful. For instance, he makes this general point, which I think is true. We're more fearful of things that we don't control. So a lot more people die on the roads. They die driving than they do in an airplane crash. But an airplane crash, it's not like, well, yeah, I was, you know, I have control over my own. It's what you know. And that's one of the things about COVID-19, especially when you don't know anything about this, unlike, say, the flu. You don't really know. So you're, in effect, flying blind. But then he throws that in. And I think it's a startling statistic. I think more germane are the statistics that he has from other occupations. And for instance, taxi drivers and bus drivers, according to this one investigation or study, they are 4 times more likely than the average person to get it. And that makes a lot of sense because they're dealing with people, you know, new people, strange people, all sorts of different kinds of people. And when you gauge that, they say that teachers, I'm not sure, compulsory, I guess that means elementary education or something. Compulsory education, there is a little more danger than, say, grocery workers. But high school teachers, which we have been finding out, high school students are more transmissible. You know, they're more apt to infect people, even has a lower rate. So one of the impact of that is, Let's apply this to opening schools. We figured out a way to open stores. Right now, grocery stores have been open through most of the pandemic, and right now they have a slightly less than average rate of dying.
Yes.
So he says, so in effect, we figured out, now, I mean, it's awful because, you know, there have been dozens of people that have died in grocery store working that they might not have if it wasn't during COVID-19. But that seems to be a societally acceptable risk. If the if schools are just a little bit more than that, and we acknowledge that it's riskier and they're doing something for the good of society, he says maybe we ought to open up schools, because the downside, you know, also is a negative, that people fall back in terms of learning, and the parents can then go back to work maybe. But he does say that we should then acknowledge that they're taking a risk and somehow compensate them for that, pay them more.
Who's taking? That's what I said.
Yeah, it is. He ended up coming to the conclusion that you did. Says, yes, we'll be willing to pay teachers more for doing that, which I think is a great idea. And I'm happy if people are willing to pay more for people that do that. There are 2 complications. How much? And the other thing is, he says in his article, Learning to Live with the Coronavirus Risk, that we shouldn't make teachers work. Well, if they don't want to work, or they don't feel like the compensation is enough and they choose not to, what? Are they unemployed? Do we pay them anyway? There are some economic complications with that.
Right. I understand that, but someone needs to look at what the science. The governor likes to talk about science. The science, yes, if we have the people that went into the canary that went into the coal mine first is Europe, and they've got those kids in school. So the idea of treating schools like it's some sort of hot zone is ridiculous. If we see that the science is they don't contract it, your chances of getting it are X. If you're under a certain age, if a teacher is like concerned and they reach a certain age, then every sort of thing, then you can teach online if you want. But you're going to have to really, if you make the decision that you want to not be in the classroom, then someone has to truly begin to monitor how hard you're working with your online stuff. And
So would that be allowed? In this, I like this guy's scenario.
Yes.
It's a little rosy, but so let's say, you know, you're like Greenwood School. You're opening up. It's an elementary school. And 3 of the teachers are in their 60s. And so they think the risk isn't worth it to them.
Buy them out early retirement.
Okay, so let's say you've got a really obese 45-year-old.
Okay.
So they have a core morbidity that makes them vulnerable, and yes. So they choose not to. Can you have two fifth-grade classes and one be in-person and one be online? I don't know if that would fly.
I don't know. This is
okay. These are just some of the complications. But that his basic argument is, hey, teachers are not at a huge risk. It's not like working at a meat processing plant. It's not like being a taxi driver. But there is some risk. Society should acknowledge it and then open up the schools for everybody that is willing to take the pay for the added risk.
St. Monica over in Mercer Island has had its highest enrollment in years.
Why? You mean because of the pandemic?
Yeah. You know why?
Well, they didn't stay open, did
they? Opening.
Oh, they're opening.
They're going to open.
In person or online or hybrid or what?
I think they're going to have them in there. The thing is that they have most amount of people have applied to go to St. Monica's. It's a great little school, good little Catholic school. It's been around for a long time, dedicated teachers, and they're open for business. And people are like, okay, where can I send my kid? I'll send my kid to St. Monica's.
Well, yeah, but that doesn't mean it's good social policy. But, yeah, if you're a parent and you can send your kid somewhere.
Isn't it up to the parent?
Well, isn't it on Mercer Island?
It is on Mercer Island, yeah.
Well, I know. So a lot of people can't get to Mercer Island. If you're on Mercer Island, yes.
No. You're saying is that good? Was your term? Is that good social?
Yeah, good. Is it good for society? In other words, I think there are enough desperate parents that would put any kid anywhere, uh-huh, in any school, just so they don't have to stay at home and either work with them, take care of them, or help them online. If they're not offering online classes, instead they're offering, I think most parents would jump at that.
Yeah, well.
So the fact that there's a demand doesn't necessarily mean that that's a good, that you can apply it society-wide.
Oh, I know. I'm just pointing out that, yeah, some people are benefiting, yeah, from the fact that some of these public schools, the teachers don't want to go back to work. And others that are opening up, the parents are saying, I will send my kid there.
Well, it's the school district. It's not just the teachers. It's the school districts that are deciding what the safest approach is.
Right. But don't you think it's the dog, the tail wagging the dog on that?
Yeah,
Isn't it the unions that are really pushing and saying, well, this is what we want?
I don't know that. Yes. Some teachers unions, some national teachers unions, I think the second largest, have come out. But they came out after most of these school districts have already made their decision. One other point, just to complicate this guy's scenario, because I do like his approach. He says, well, let's look at Sweden, and they found out that teachers weren't any more liable to get sick than someone in the general population.
Right.
The problem is, and this has been pointed out, the difference in this country and the schools that are open in Europe are that the transmission level was already very low.
Uh-huh.
And so this would be a grand experiment to have cases are so much greater. We don't know that would be the same case, because when they tried it in Israel, they said they had all sorts of complications in Israel when Israel had a higher transmission rate. So they're just complications, but I think this guy's general idea is a decent one.
Yeah. I the other article that we read through too is don't open and close and open and close and open and,
yes,
close and causing more problems. Oh, by the way, looking on St. Monica's website, they're going to do everything to, yeah, make sure the kids are safe, and this is a fluid situation, but as it is right now, they are going to be unquestioning 20 fall, will look different in the fall. Yeah, so they're going to be doing what they need to do in order to appeal and apply to make sure everybody feels good about having their kid there.
Yeah, well, and so far, there are not too many schools that have come out and done that. So they're saying they're not going to do, nothing's going to be done online.
No. They just said they're flexible at this point, Tom.
Oh, okay. Well, then they may be different.
They may be like everybody
else.
Yeah. All righty. Good school, though.
Yeah, that's what I hear.
Yep.
I'm a product of parochial schools.
Look at that. That should be a reason for everybody to head out to parochial schools. Bob Ross, why is he still popular today, even though he's been dead for a long time? I've heard that every 3 weeks they dig him up and they perm his hair again. Is that true? We'll be right back. Sean's in one of those moods, Tom. You should see his face over there.
Is he grooving or grumpy?
He's grooving.
I'm grooving.
I'm good. Grooving the music. Bob Ross used to be on PBS. I don't know what time. He was on Saturdays or something. My mom is an artist. She used to watch him every once in a while. And he could knock out a painting in like 20 minutes. The trees were always happy. And You sit there like trying to keep up, and that's the biggest problem. Now, when you follow Bob Ross, you can stop because you're watching it on YouTube. So you stop and you work on the tree. But the speed in which he used to work made it really hard if you were aspiring to be Bob Ross to try to paint like Bob Ross. But it was very relaxing to watch him do it because you're more like, oh, I see where the highlights go, as he talks about where the sun is and where the shadow is.
I want to get you to try being creative on canvas, just to take your time and sit down, have nothing in mind when you start.
All right.
Just have a good feeling and be happy and in love with life and your world and sit down and begin playing.
Oh, all right.
And if you feel good about yourself and the world, it'll show in your painting and all these little things will happen.
If you happen to get some of it down in here, who cares?
Okay.
We'll end up turning that into reflections.
Oopsie.
We don't make mistakes.
Well, I just made
we have happy accidents.
Don't worry about it.
Learn how to use
your big what happy accident. Yes.
That's the name of the game. It's enjoying. Really ought to enjoy what you do in life.
I'm still working on the sunset.
If you do, then you'll do a good job.
No.
I spent half my life in the military.
Wow.
And there I had to live in somebody else's world all the time. And painting offered me freedom. I'd come home after all day of playing soldier, and I'd paint a picture, and I could paint the kind of world that I wanted.
Is he sharpening like a bayonet? Is that what that sound is? And then what I did was I heard the screams. I heard the screams. I saw the smoke. We went in there. None of them were armed. The point is in this article that Bob Ross is as popular today as ever because even back in the 70s, Bob Ross was teaching all of us to be mindful.
Yeah, well, in fact, that's one of the things. So why is it that his show went off the air? It was in the 80s, I think, was off the air by the mid-90s. Why is he so perennially popular? And a couple of things are, and Now, I wouldn't say that to me, he's like this, a great joke. He's like an icon of a certain era, and it's, if you want to reference a certain time frame, he's there. But I didn't realize that people found him soothing. To me, it felt like a parlor trick. Wow, watch this guy. In 24 minutes, he's going to paint an entire landscape. Oh, look at how quickly he can, make a snow cap of a mountain or the leaves and trees. I mean, it was more like, wow, look at this guy work. It never occurred to me that, I was supposed to be painting along with him at the very same time. Of course, you'd think it was too fast if you're actually trying to paint. But to me, it was just sort of like, oh, look at this, a good card trick or something. I didn't really take it seriously, but what the people that do take it seriously, of course, there's a little tongue-in-cheek fandom about his popularity, but also that calming, soothing presentation. I never really watched him enough to notice that, but that's what everyone says, and they say that, anticipated by decades, the whole mindfulness phenomenon we're on right now, that he's soothing, and nothing is ever wrong, everything is a happy accident.
Well, I tell you something wrong went for me. When I was in my father's carpenter shop, when I cut off my index finger.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I turned it into a stone.
I dropped out of school in ninth grade, and I went into the Air Force, and didn't like people screaming at me about cleaning the latrines.
It's true.
I didn't like that.
So he made some of himself, and he died when he was only 53, John.
That's when I wanted to die.
Oh, you're terrible. But he's incredibly popular. There are thousands of now Bob Ross approved instructors, so you too can recreate bad paintings as well as Bob Ross ever did.